study door? Jubal turned his head. Larry, open the door. He put a hand on Mike. Don't get excited, lad.
Yes, Jubal. That man, I have known him.
And he knows you.
Over his shoulder, Jubal called out,
Come in, Sergeant.
An SS sergeant stood in the doorway, mob gun at ready. He called out,
Major, here they are!
Douglas said, Let me speak to the officer commanding them, Doctor. Jubal was relieved to see that the major showed up with his sidearm holstered. Mike had been trembling ever since the sergeant's gun had come into view. Jubal lavished no love on these troopers, but he did not want Smith to display his powers. The major glanced around.
You're Jubal Harshaw?
Yes, come here, your boss wants you.
None of that, come along. I'm also looking for...
Come here! The Secretary General wants a word with you.
The SS major looked startled, came into the study, and in sight of the screen, looked at it, snapped to attention, and saluted. Douglas nodded.
Name, rank, and duty.
Sir, Major C. D. Block, Special Services Squadron, Cheerio, Enclave Barracks.
Tell me what you were doing.
Sir, that's rather complicated. I...
Then unravel it. Speak up, Major.
Yes, sir. I came here pursuant to orders. You see?
I don't see.
Well, sir, an hour and a half ago, a flying squad was sent here to make several arrests. When we couldn't raise them by radio, I was sent to find them and render assistance.
Whose orders?
The Commandant, sir.
And did you find them?
No, sir. Not a trace.
Douglas looked at Harshaw.
Counselor, did you see anything of another squad?
It's not my duty to keep track of your servants, Mr. Secretary.
That is hardly an answer to my question.
You are correct, sir. I'm not being interrogated. Nor will I be other than by due process. I'm acting for my client. I'm not nursemaid to these uniformed, persons. But I suggest, from what I've seen, that they could not find a pig in a bathtub.
Possibly. Major, round up your men and return.
Yes, sir.
The major saluted.
Just a moment, Harshaw interrupted. These men broke into my house. I demand to see their warrant.
Oh. Major, show him your warrant.
Major Block turned red.
Sir, the officer ahead of me had the warrants.
Douglas stared.
Young man, are you telling me that you broke into a citizen's home
without a warrant?
But, sir, you don't understand. There are warrants. Captain Heinrich has them.
Sir.
Douglas looked disgusted.
Get on back. Place yourself under arrest. I'll see you later.
Yes, sir.
Hold it,
Harshaw demanded.
I exercise my right to make citizens arrest. I should have him placed in our local lockup. Armed breaking and entering.
Douglas blinked.
Is this necessary?
I think it is. These fellas seem awfully hard to find. I don't want this one to leave our local jurisdiction. Aside from criminal matters, I haven't had opportunity to assess property damage.
You have my assurance, sir, that you will be fully compensated.
Thank you, sir. But what is to keep another uniformed joker from coming along later? He wouldn't even need to break down the door. My castle stands violated, open to any intruder, Mr. Secretary. Only the moments of delay afforded by my once stout door kept this scoundrel from dragging me away before I could reach you. And you heard him say that there's another like him at large, with, so he says, warrants.
Doctor, I know nothing of any such warrant.
Warrants, sir. He said warrants for several arrests. Perhaps a better term would be lettre de cachet.
That's a serious imputation.
This is a serious matter.
Doctor, I know nothing of these warrants, if they exist, but I give you my personal assurance that I will look into it at once, find out why they were issued, and act as the merits may appear. Can I say more?
You can say a great deal more, sir.
I can reconstruct why those warrants were issued. Someone in your service, in an excess of zeal, caused a pliant judge to issue them for the purpose of seizing the persons of myself and my guests in order to question us out of your sight.
Out of anyone's sight, sir. We will discuss issues with you, but we will not be questioned by such as this.
Jubal hooked a thumb at the major.
In some windowless back room. Sir, I hope for justice at your hands. But if those warrants are not canceled at once, if I'm not assured beyond quibble that the man from Mars, Nurse Boardman, and myself will be undisturbed, free to come and go, then,
Jubal shrugged helplessly,
I must seek a champion. There are persons and powers outside the administration who hold deep interest in the affairs of the man from Mars.
You threaten me?
No, sir. I plead with you. We wish to negotiate, but we cannot while being hounded. I beg you, sir. Call off your dogs.
Douglas glanced aside. Those warrants, if any, will not be served. As soon as I can track them down, they will be canceled.
Thank you, sir.
Douglas looked at Major Block. You insist on booking him?
Him? Oh, he's merely a fool in uniform. Let's forget damages, too. You and I have serious matters to discuss.
You may go, Major. The SS officer saluted and left abruptly. Douglas continued.
Counselor, the matters you raise cannot be settled over the telephone.
I agree.
You and your, client will be my guests at the palace. I'll send my yacht. Can you be ready in an hour?
Harshaw shook his head.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. We'll sleep here, and when it comes time, I'll dig up a dog sled or something. No need to send your yacht.
Mr. Douglas frowned. Conductor, as you pointed out, conversations will be quasi-diplomatic. In proffering protocol, I have conceded this. Therefore, I must be allowed to provide official hospitality.
Well, sir, my client has had too much official hospitality. He had the devil's own time getting shut of it.
Douglas's face became rigid.
Sir, are you implying?
I'm not implying anything. Smith has been through a lot and is not used to high-level ceremony. He'll sleep sounder here, and so shall I. I'm an old man, sir. I prefer my own bed. I might point out that talks may break down and my client would be forced to look elsewhere, in which case we would find it embarrassing to be guests under your roof.
The Secretary General looked grim.
Threats again. I thought you trusted me, sir. I distinctly heard you say that you were ready to negotiate.
I do trust you, sir.
As far as I could throw a fit.
And we are ready to negotiate. But I use negotiate in its original sense, not in this newfangled meaning of appeasement. However, we will be reasonable. But we can't start talks at once. We're shy of one factor and must wait.
How long, I don't know.
What do you mean?
We expect the administration to be represented by whatever delegation you choose.
And we have the same privilege.
Surely. But let's keep it small. I shall handle this myself with an assistant or two. The Solicitor General, our experts in space law. To transact business requires a small group. The smaller the better.
Most certainly.
Our group will be small. Smith, myself. I'll bring a fair witness.
Oh, come now. A witness does not hamper.
We'll have one or two others, but we lack one man. I have instructions that a fellow named Ben Caxton must be present, and I can't find the beggar.
Jubal, having spent hours of maneuvering in order to toss in this one remark, waited. Douglas stared.
Ben Caxton? Surely you don't mean that cheap Winchell?
The Caxton I refer to has a column with one of the syndicates.
Out of the question!
Harshaw shook his head.
Then that's all, Mr. Secretary. My instructions give me no leeway. I'm sorry to have wasted your time. I beg to be excused.
He reached out as if to switch off.
Hold it!
Sir?
I'm not through speaking to you.
I beg the Secretary General's pardon. We will wait until he excuses us.
Yes, yes, never mind. Doctor, do you read the tripe that comes out of this capital labeled news?
Good heavens, no.
I wish I didn't have to. It's preposterous to talk about having journalists present. We'll see them after everything is settled, but even if we were to admit them, Caxton would not be one. The man is poisonous, a keyhole sniffer of the worst sort.
Mr. Secretary, we have no objections to publicity. In fact, we insist on it.
Ridiculous,
possibly. But I serve my client as I think best. If we reach agreement affecting the man from Mars and the planet, which is his home, I want every person on this planet to know how it was done and what was agreed. Contrariwise, if we fail, people must hear how the talks broke down. There will be no star chamber, Mr. Secretary.
Damn it, I wasn't speaking of a star chamber and you know it. I mean quiet, orderly talks without elbows jostled.
Then let the press in, sir, through cameras and microphones, but with elbows outside. Which reminds me, we will be interviewed, my client and I, over the networks later today, and I shall announce that we want public talks.
What? You mustn't give out interviews now? Why, that's contrary to the whole spirit of this discussion.
I can't see that it is. Are you suggesting that a citizen must have your permission to speak to the press?
No, of course not. But
I'm afraid it's too late.
Arrangements have been made, and the only way you could stop it would be by sending more carloads of thugs. My reason for mentioning it is that you might wish to give out a news release in advance, telling the public that the man from Mars has returned and is vacationing in the Poconos, so as to avoid any appearance that the government was taken by surprise. You follow me?
I follow you.
The Secretary General stared at Harshaw.
Please wait.
He left the screen. Harshaw motioned Larry to him while his other hand covered the sound pickup.
Look, son, he whispered. With that transceiver out, I'm bluffing on a busted flush. I don't know whether he left issue that release or is going to set the dogs on us again. You hightail out, get Tom McKenzie on another phone, tell him that if he doesn't get the setup working, he's going to miss the biggest story since the fall of Troy. Then be careful coming home. There may be cops.
How do I call McKenzie?
Douglas was back on screen. Speak to Miriam.
Dr. Harshaw, I took your suggestion. A release, much as you worded it, plus substantiating details.
Douglas smiled in his homespun persona.
I added that the administration will discuss interplanetary relations with the man from Mars as soon as he had rested from his trip, and would do so publicly. Quite publicly.
His smile became chilly, and he stopped looking like good old Joe Douglas. Harshaw grinned in admiration, while the old thief had rolled with the punch and turned a defeat into a coup for the administration.
That's perfect, Mr. Secretary. We'll back you right down the line.
Thank you. Now about this Caxton person. Letting the press in does not apply to him. He can watch it over Stereovision and make up his lies from that, but he will not be present.
Then there will be no talks, Mr. Secretary, no matter what you told the press.
I don't believe you understand me, Counselor. This man is offensive to me. Personal privilege.
You are correct, sir. It is a matter of personal privilege.
Then we'll say no more about it.
You misunderstand me. It is indeed personal privilege. But not yours. Smith's. Eh? You are privileged to select your advisors. Then you can fetch the devil himself and we shall not complain. Smith is privileged to select his advisors and have them present. If Caxton is not present, we will not be there. We will be at some quite different conference, one where you won't be welcome, even if you speak Hindi.
Harshaw thought clinically that a man of Douglas's age should not indulge in rage. At last, Douglas spoke to the man from Mars. Mike had stayed on screen as silently and as patiently as the witness. Douglas said,
"Smith, why do you insist on this ridiculous condition?"
Harshaw said instantly,
"Don't answer, Mike."
Then to Douglas,
"Tut, tut, Mr. Secretary, the canons.
You may not inquire why my client has instructed me, and the canons are violated with exceptional grievance in that my client has but lately learned English and cannot hold his own against you. If you will learn Martian, I may permit you to put the question in his language, but not today."
Douglas frowned.
I might inquire what canons you have played fast and loose with. But I haven't time. I have a government to run. I yield. But don't expect me to shake hands with this Caxton.
As you wish, sir.
Now back to the first point. I haven't been able to find Caxton.
Douglas laughed.
You insisted on a privilege. One I find offensive. Bring whom you like. But round them up yourself.
Reasonable, sir. But would you do the man from Mars a favor?
Eh? What favor?
Talks will not begin until Caxton is located. That is not subject to argument. But I have not been able to find him. I am merely a private citizen.
What do you mean?
I spoke disparagingly of the Special Service Squadrons.
Check it off to the irk of a man who has had his door broken down. But I know that they can be amazingly efficient, and they have the cooperation of police forces everywhere.
Mr. Secretary, if you were to call in your SS commandant and tell him that you wanted to locate a man at once, well, sir, it would produce more activity in an hour than I could in a century.
Why on earth should I alert police forces everywhere to find one scandal-mongering reporter?
Not on Earth, my dear sir, on Mars. I ask you this as a favor to the man from Mars.
Well, it's preposterous, but I'll go along.
Douglas looked at Mike.
As a favor to Smith, I expect similar cooperation when we get down to cases.
You have my assurance that it will ease the situation enormously. Well, I can't promise anything. You say the man is missing, he may have fallen in front of a truck, he may be dead.
Harshaw looked grave. Let us hope not, for all our sakes.
What do you mean?
I've tried to point out the possibility to my client. But he won't listen to the idea.
Harshaw sighed.
A shambles, sir. If we can't find this Caxton, that is what we will have. A shambles.
Well, I'll try. Don't expect miracles, Doctor.
Not I, sir, my client. He has the Martian viewpoint, and does expect miracles. Let's pray for one.
You'll hear from me. That's all I can say.
Harshaw bowed without getting up.
Your servant, sir.
As Douglas's image cleared, Jubal stood up and found Jillian's arms around his neck.
Oh, Jubal, you were wonderful.
We on out of the woods, child.
But if anything can save Ben, you've just done it.
She kissed him.
Hey, none of that. I swore off before you were born. Kindly show respect for my years.
He kissed her carefully and thoroughly.
That's to take away the taste of Douglas. Between kicking him and kissing him, I was getting nauseated. Go smooch Mike, he deserves it, for holding still to my lies.
Oh, I shall.
Jill let go of Harshaw, put her arms around the man from Mars.
Such wonderful lies, Jubal.
She kissed Mike. Jubal watched as Mike initiated a second section of the kiss himself, performing it solemnly, but not quite as a novice. Harshaw awarded him B-, with A for effort.
Son, he said, you amaze me. I would have expected you to curl up in one of your faints.
I so did, Mike answered seriously, without letting go, on first kissing time.
Well, congratulations, Jill. AC or DC?
Jubal, you're a tease, but I love you anyhow and refuse to let you get my goat.
Mike got a little upset once, but no longer, as you can see.
Yes, Mike agreed.
It is a goodness. For Water Brothers, it is a growing closer.
I will show you.
He let go of Jill. Jubal put up a palm.
No.
No?
You'd be disappointed, son. It's a growing closer for Water Brothers, only if they are young girls and pretty, such as Jill.
My brother Jubal, you speak rightly?
I speak very rightly. Kiss girls all you want to, it beats the hell out of card games.
Beg pardon?
It's a fine way to grow closer. With girls.
Jubal looked around.
I wonder if that first-time phenomenon would repeat. Dorcas, I want your help in a scientific experiment.
Boss, I'm not a guinea pig. You go to hell.
In due course I shall. Don't be difficult, girl. Mike has no communicable diseases, or I wouldn't let him use the pool. Which reminds me, Miriam, when Larry gets back, tell him I want the pool cleaned. We're through with murkiness. Well, Dorcas?
How do you know it would be our first time?
There's that. Mike, have you ever kissed Dorcas?
No, Jubal. Only today did I learn that Dorcas is my water brother.
She is?
Yes. Dorcas and Anne and Miriam and Larry. They are your water brothers, my brother Jubal.
Yes. Correct, in essence.
Yes, it is essence, the grokking. Not sharing of water.
I speak rightly? Very rightly, Mike.
They are your water brothers.
Mike paused to think words.
In catenative assemblage, they are my brothers.
Mike looked at Dorcas.
For brothers, growing closer is good.
Jubal said,
Well, Dorcas?
Huh? Oh, heavens, boss, you're the world's worst tease. But Mike isn't teasing. He's sweet.
She went to him, stood on tiptoes, held up her arms.
Kiss me, Mike.
Mike did. For some seconds they grew closer. Dorcas fainted. Jubal kept her from falling. Jill had to speak sharply to Mike to keep him from trembling into withdrawal. Dorcas came out of it and assured Mike that she was all right and would happily grow closer again, but needed to catch her breath.
Whew!
Miriam had watched round-eyed.
I wonder if I dare risk it,
Anne said.
By seniority, please. Boss, are you through with me as a witness?
For the time being.
Then hold my cloak. Want to bet on it?
Which way?
7-2, I don't faint. But I wouldn't mind losing.
Done.
Dollars, not hundreds. Mike, dear, let's grow lots closer. Anne was forced to give up through hypoxia. Mike, with Martian training, could have gone without oxygen much longer. She gasped for air and said, I wasn't set right. Boss, I'm going to give you another chance. She started to offer her face again, but Miriam tapped her shoulder. Out. Don't be so eager. Out, I said. The foot of the line, wench. Oh, well. Anne gave way. Miriam moved in, smiled, and said nothing. They grew closer, and continued to grow closer.
Front.
Miriam looked around. Boss, can't you see I'm busy?
All right, get out of the way. I'll answer the phone myself.
Honest, I didn't hear it.
Obviously. But we've got to pretend to a modicum of dignity. It might be the Secretary General.
It was Mackenzie. Jubal, what the devil is going on?
Trouble?
I got a call from a man who urged me to drop everything and get cracking because you've got something for me. I had ordered a mobile unit to your place.
Never got here.
I know, they called in after wandering around north of you. Our dispatcher straightened them out and they should be there any moment. I tried to call you, your circuit was busy. What have I missed?
Nothing yet.
Damnation. You should have had someone monitor the battle box. Was Douglas committed? Or would a new passel of cops show up? While the kids played post office. Jubal, you're senile.
Has there been any special news flash this past hour?
Why, no. Oh, one item. The palace announced that the man from Mars had returned and was vacationing in the... Jubal, are you mixed up in that?
Just a moment. Mike, come here. And grab your robe.
Got it, boss.
Miss Mackenzie, meet the man from Mars.
Mackenzie's jaw dropped. Hold it. Let me get a camera on this. We'll pick it up off the phone and repeat in stereo as quick as those jokers of mine get there. Jubal, I'm safe on this. You wouldn't?
Would I swindle you with a fair witness at my elbow? I'm not forcing this on you. We should wait and tie in Argus and transplant it.
Jubal, you can't do this to me.
I won't. The agreement with all of you was to monitor the cameras when I signaled and use it if newsworthy. I didn't promise not to give interviews in addition, Jubal added. Not only did you loan equipment, but you've been helpful personally, Tom. I can't express how helpful.
You mean, that telephone number?
Correct. But no questions about that, Tom. Ask me privately next year.
Oh, I wouldn't think of it. You keep your lip buttoned and I'll keep mine. Now don't go away.
One more thing. Those messages you're holding, send them back to me.
Eh? All right. I've kept them in my desk. You were so fussy, Jubal. I've got a camera on you. Can we start?
Shoot.
I'm going to do this one myself.
Mackenzie turned his face and apparently looked at the camera.
Flash news, this is your NWNW reporter on the spot. While it's hot, the man from Mars just phoned and wants to talk to you. Cut. Monitor, insert flash news acknowledgement to sponsor. Jubal, anything special I should ask?
Don't ask about South America. Swimming is your safest subject. You can ask me about his plans.
End of cut. Friends, you are now face-to-face and voice-to-voice with Valentine Michael Smith, the man from Mars. As NWNW, always first with the burst, told you earlier, Mr. Smith has just returned from high in the Andes, and we welcome him back. Wave to your friends, Mr. Smith.
Wave at the telephone, son. Smile and wave.
Thank you, Valentine Michael Smith. We're happy to see you so healthy and tan. I understand you have been gathering strength by learning to swim. Boss, visitors or something? Cut. After the word swim. What the hell, Jubal?
I'll see. Geo Reinhardt on mic. It might be general quarters.
But it was the NWNW unit landing, and again rose bushes were damaged. Larry returning from phoning Mackenzie, and Duke returning. Mackenzie decided to finish the telephone interview quickly, since he was now assured of depth and color through his unit. In the meantime, its crew would check equipment on loan to Jubal. Larry and Duke went with them. The interview finished with inanities, Jubal fielding questions Mike failed to understand. Mackenzie signed off with a promise that a color and depth interview would follow.
Stay synced with this station.
He waited for his technicians to report. Which the crew boss did promptly.
Nothing wrong with this field setup, Mr. Mackenzie. Then what was wrong before?
The technician glanced at Larry and Duke.
It works better with power. The breaker was open at the board.
Harshaw stopped to wrangle about whether Duke had or had not told Larry that a circuit breaker must be reset if the equipment was to be used. Jubal did not care who was to blame. It all confirmed his conviction that technology had reached its peak with the Model T Ford and had been growing decadent ever since. They got through the depth and color interview. Mike sent greetings to his friends of the champion, including one to Dr. Mahmoud, delivered in throat-rasping Martian. At last, Jubal set the telephone for 2 hours' refusal, stretched, and felt great weariness. Wondered if he were getting old.
"Where's dinner? Which one of you wenches was supposed to cook tonight? Gad, this household has fallen to rack and ruin."
"It was my turn tonight," Jill answered. "But..."
"Excuses, always excuses."
"Boss," Anne interrupted sharply, "how do you expect anyone to cook when you've kept us penned up all afternoon?"
"That's the moose's problem," Jubal said dourly. "If Armageddon is held on these premises, I expect meals hot and on time right up to the final trump. Furthermore..."
"Furthermore," Anne completed, "it is only 7:40 and plenty of time to have dinner by 8, so quit yelping, crybaby."
"Only 20 minutes of 8? Seems like a week since lunch. You haven't left a civilized amount of time for a pre-dinner drink."
"Poor you."
"Somebody give me a drink. Get everybody a drink. Let's skip dinner. I feel like getting as tight as a tent rope in the rain. And how are we fixed for smorgasbord?"
"Plenty.
Why not thaw out 18 or 19 kinds and let everybody eat when it feels like it? What's all the argument?"
"Right away," agreed Jill. Anne stopped to kiss him on his bald spot. "Boss, you've done nobly. We'll feed you and get you drunk and put you to bed. Wait, Jill, I'll help."
"I'm made to help, too," Smith said eagerly.
"Sure, Mike, you can carry trays. Boss, dinner will be by the pool. It's a hot night."
"How else?"
When they left, Jubal said to Duke,
"Where the hell have you been?"
"Thinking."
"Doesn't pay. Makes you discontented. Any results?"
"Yes," said Duke. "I've decided that what Mike eats is his business."
"Congratulations. A desire not to butt into other people's business is 80% of all human wisdom."
"You butt into other people's business."
"Who said I was wise?"
"Jubal, if I offered Mike a glass of water, would he go through that lodge routine?"
"I think he would." "Duke, the only human characteristic Mike has is an overwhelming desire to be liked. But I want to make sure you know how serious it is. I accepted Water Brotherhood with Mike before I understood it, and I've become deeply entangled with its responsibilities. You'll be committing yourself never to lie to him, never to mislead him, to stick by him come what may. Better think about it."
"I have been thinking about it. Jubal, there's something about Mike that makes you want to care for him."
"I know. You've probably never encountered honesty before. Innocence. Mike has never tasted the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, so we don't understand what makes him tick. Well, I hope you never regret it."
Jubal looked up.
"I thought you had stopped to distill the stuff."
Larry answered,
"Couldn't find a corkscrew."
"Machinery again. Duke, you find glasses behind the anatomy of melancholy up there.
I know where you hide them.
And we'll have a quick one before we get down to serious drinking."
Duke got glasses, Jubal poured, and raised his own.
"Here's to alcoholic brotherhood, more suited to the frail human soul than any other sort.
Health. Cheers."
Jubal poured his down his throat.
"Ah,"
he said happily, and belched.
"Offer some to Mike, Duke, and let him learn how good it is to be human. Makes me feel creative. Front. Why are those girls never around when I need them? Front."
"I'm front,"
Miriam answered at the door.
"But I was saying, to what strange bittersweet fate my tomboy ambition."
"I finished that story while you were chatting with the Secretary General."
"Then you are no longer front. Send it off."
"Don't you want to read it? Anyhow, I've got to revise it. Kissing Mike gave me new insight."
Jubal shuddered.
"Read it? Good God, it's bad enough to write such a thing. And don't consider revising, certainly not to fit the facts. My child, a true confession story should never be tarnished by any taint of truth."
"Okay, boss. Anne says to come to the pool and have a bite before you eat."
"Can't think of a better time. Shall we adjourn, gentlemen?"
The party progressed liquidly, with bits of fish and other Scandinavian comestibles added to taste. At Jubal's invitation, Mike tried brandy. Mike found the result disquieting. So he analyzed his trouble, added oxygen to ethanol in an inner process of reverse fermentation, and converted it to glucose and water. Jubal had been observing the effect of liquor on the man from Mars, saw him become drunk, saw him sober up even more quickly. In an attempt to understand, Jubal urged more brandy on Mike, which he accepted since his water brother offered it. Mike sopped up an extravagant quantity before Jubal conceded that it was impossible to get him drunk. Such was not the case with Jubal, despite years of pickling. Staying sociable with Mike during the experiment dulled his wits, so when he asked Mike what he had done, Mike thought that he was inquiring about the raid by the SS, concerning which Mike felt latent guilt. He tried to explain, and, if needed, receive Jubal's pardon. Jubal interrupted when he realized what the boy was talking about.
"Son, I don't want to know. You did what was needed, just perfect." "But,"
he blinked owlishly,
"don't tell me. Don't ever tell anybody."
"Not?"
"Not. Damnedest thing I've seen since my uncle with two heads debated free silver and refuted himself. An explanation would spoil it."
"I do not grok."
"Nor I, so let's have another drink."
Reporters started arriving. Jubal received them with courtesy, invited them to eat, drink, and relax, but refrained from badgering himself or the man from Mars. Those who failed to heed were tossed into the pool. Jubal kept Larry and Duke at flank to administer baptism. While some became angry, others added themselves to the dousing squad with the fanatic enthusiasm of proselytes. Jubal had to stop them from ducking the doyen Lipman of the New York Times a third time. Late in the evening, Dorcas sought out Jubal and whispered,
"Telephone, boss."
"Take a message."
"You must answer, boss."
"I'll answer it with an axe. I've been intending to get rid of that Iron Maiden, and I'm in the mood. Duke, get me an axe."
"Boss, it's the man you spoke to for a long time this afternoon."
"Oh. Why didn't you say so?"
Jubal lumbered upstairs, bolted his door, went to the phone. Another of Douglas's acolytes was on screen, but was replaced by Douglas.
"It took you long enough to answer your phone."
"It's my phone, Mr. Secretary. Sometimes I don't answer it at all."
"So it seems. Why didn't you tell me Caxton is an alcoholic?"
"Is he?"
"He certainly is. He's been on a bender. He was sleeping it off in a flea bag in Sonora."
"I'm glad to hear he's been found."
"Thank you, sir." "He's been picked up for vagrancy. The charge won't be pressed. We are releasing him to you."
"I'm in your debt, sir."
"Oh, it's not entirely a favor. I'm having him delivered as he was found, filthy, unshaven, and I understand smelling like a brewery. I want you to see what a tramp he is."
"Very well, sir. When may I expect him?"
"A courier left Nogales some time ago. At Mach 4 it should be overhead soon. The pilot will deliver him and get a receipt."
"He shall have it."
"Now, Counselor, I wash my hands of it. I expect you and your client to appear, whether you bring that drunken libeler or not."
"Agreed." "When?"
"Tomorrow at 10.
'Twere best done quickly." "Agreed."
Jubal went downstairs and outside.
"Jill!"
"Come here, child."
"Yes, Jubal."
She trotted toward him, a reporter with her. Jubal waved him back.
"Private,"
he said firmly.
"Family matter."
"Whose family?"
"A death in yours. Scat!"
The newsman grinned and left. Jubal leaned over and said softly,
"He's safe."
"Ben?"
"Yes, he'll be here soon."
"Oh, Jubal!"
She started to bawl. He took her shoulders.
"Stop it. Go inside until you get control."
"Yes, boss."
"Go cry on your pillow, then wash your face."
He went out to the pool.
"Quiet, everybody. I have an announcement. We've enjoyed having you, but the party is over."
"Boo!"
"Toss him in the pool. I'm an old man and need my rest, and so does my family. Do cork those bottles. Girls, clear the food away."
There was grumbling. The more responsible quieted their colleagues. In 10 minutes they were gone. In 20 minutes Caxton arrived. The SS officer commanding the car accepted Harshaw's signature and print on a prepared receipt, left while Jill sobbed on Ben's shoulder. Jubal looked him over.
"Ben, I hear you've been drunk for a week."
Ben cursed while continuing to pat Jill's back.
"Drunk, all right, but haven't had a drink."
"What happened?"
"I don't know. I don't know."
An hour later, Ben's stomach had been pumped. Jubal had given him shots to offset alcohol and barbiturates. He was bathed, shaved, dressed in borrowed clothes, had met the man from Mars, and was sketchily brought up to date while ingesting milk and food. But he was unable to bring them up to date. For Ben, the week had not happened. He had become unconscious in Washington, had been shaken into wakefulness in Mexico. "Of course I know what happened. They kept me doped in a dark room and wrung me out. But I can't prove anything. Here's the village jefe and the madman of this dive. Plus, I'm sure other witnesses to swear how this gringo spent his time, and there's nothing I can do about it."
"Then don't," Jubal advised. "Relax and be happy."
"The hell I will. I'll get that..."
"Tut, tut, Ben, you're alive, which I would have given long odds against. And Douglas is going to do exactly what we want him to, and like it."
"I want to talk about that.
I think you're going to bed with a glass of warm milk to conceal old Doc Harshaw's secret ingredient for secret drinkers."
Soon Caxton was snoring. Jubal was heading for bed and encountered Anne in the upper hall. He shook his head tiredly.
"Quite a day, lass."
"Yes. I wouldn't have missed it and don't want to repeat it. Go to bed, boss."
"In a moment. Anne, what's so special about the way that lad kisses?"
Anne looked dreamy, then dimpled. "You should have tried it."
"I'm too old to change, but I'm interested in everything about the boy. Is this something different?"
Anne pondered it. "Yes."
"How?"
"Mike gives a kiss his whole attention."
"Oh, rats, I do myself. Or did."
Anne shook her head. "No. I've been kissed by men who did a very good job, but they don't give kissing their whole attention. They can't. No matter how hard they try, parts of their minds are on something else. Missing the last bus, or their chances of making the gal, or their own techniques in kissing, or maybe worry about jobs or money, or will husband or papa or the neighbors catch on. Mike doesn't have technique. But when Mike kisses you, he isn't doing anything else. You're his whole universe. And the moment is eternal because he doesn't have any plans and isn't going anywhere. Just kissing you." She shivered. "It's overwhelming."
"Hmm."
"Don't hmm at me, you old lecher. You don't understand."
"No. I'm sorry to say I never will. Well, good night. And by the way, I told Mike to bolt his door."
She made a face at him. "Spoil sport."
"He's learning fast enough. Mustn't rush him."
Chapter 18. The conference was postponed 24 hours, which gave Caxton time to recuperate, to hear about his missing week, and to grow closer with the man from Mars. For Mike grokked that Jill and Ben were water brothers, consulted Jill, and solemnly offered water to Ben. Ben had been briefed by Jill. It caused him much soul-searching. Ben was bothered by an uneasy feeling. He felt irked at the closeness between Mike and Jill. His bachelor attitudes had been changed by a week of undead oblivion. He proposed to Jill again as soon as he got her alone. Jill looked away. "Please, Ben."
"Why not? I've got a steady job. I'm in good health. Or will be as soon as I get their truth drugs out of my system. And since I haven't, I feel a compulsion to tell the truth. I love you. I want to marry you and rub your poor, tired feet. Am I too old? Or are you planning to marry somebody else?"
"No, neither one." "Dear Ben. Ben, I love you. But don't ask me this now. I have responsibilities."
He could not budge her.
He finally realized that the man from Mars wasn't a rival. He was Jill's patient. And a man who marries a nurse must accept the fact that nurses feel maternal toward their charges. Accept it and like it. For if Jillian had not had the character that made her a nurse, he would not love her. It was not the figure eight in which her pert Fanny moved when she walked, nor the lush view from the other direction. He was not the infantile type interested solely in the size of mammary glands. No, it was herself he loved. Since what she was would make it necessary for him to take second place to patients who needed her, then he was bloody be damned not going to be jealous. Mike was a nice kid, as innocent and guileless as Jill had described him. And he wasn't offering Jill a bed of roses. The wife of a newspaper man had things to put up with. He might be gone for weeks at a time, and his hours were always irregular. He wouldn't like it if Jill bitched. But Jill wouldn't. Having reached this summing up, Ben accepted water from Mike wholeheartedly. Jubal needed the extra day to plan.
Ben, when you dumped this in my lap, I told Jillian that I would not lift a finger to get this boy his so-called rights. I've changed my mind. We're not going to let the government have the swag. Certainly not this administration, nor any. The next will be worse. Ben, you undervalue Joe Douglas. He's a cheap politician with morals to match. Yes, and ignorant to six decimal places. But he is also a fairly conscientious world chief, better than we deserve. I would enjoy poker with him. He wouldn't cheat, and he would pay up with a smile. Oh, he's an SOB. But that reads swell old boy, too. He's middling decent.
Jubal, I'm damned if I understand you. You told me that you'd been fairly certain that Douglas had had me killed. And it wasn't far from it. You juggled eggs to get me out alive, and God knows I'm grateful, but do you expect me to forget that Douglas was behind it? It's none of his doing that I'm alive. He would rather see me dead.
I suppose he would. But, yep, just that. Forget it.
I'm damned if I will.
You'd be silly not to. You can't prove anything. And there's no call to be grateful to me, and I won't let you lay this burden on me. I didn't do it for you.
Huh?
I did it for a little girl who was about to go charging out and maybe get herself killed. I did it because she was my guest, and I stood in loco parentis. I did it because she was all guts and gallantry, but too ignorant a monkey with such a buzzsaw. But you, my cynical and sin-stained chum, know all about buzzsaws. If your carelessness causes you to back into one, who am I to tamper with your karma?
Okay, Jubal, you can go to hell. For monkeying with my karma.
If I have one. A moot point. The predestinationers and free willers were tied in the fourth quarter, last I heard. Either way, I have no wish to disturb a man sleeping in a gutter. Do-gooding is like treating hemophilia. The real cure is to let hemophiliacs bleed to death before they breed more hemophiliacs.
You could sterilize them.
You would have me play God? But we're off the subject. Douglas didn't try to have you assassinated.
Says who?
Says the infallible Jubal Harshaw, speaking ex-cathedra from his belly button. Son, if your deputy sheriff beats a prisoner to death, it's sweepstakes odds that the county commissioners wouldn't have permitted it had they known. At worst, they shut their eyes afterwards, rather than upset apple carts. Assassination has never been a policy in this country.
I'll show you backgrounds of a number of deaths I've looked into.
Jubal waved it aside.
I said it wasn't a policy. We've always had assassination, from prominent ones like Huey Long to men beaten to death with hardly a page 8 story. But it's never been a policy. And the reason you are alive is that it is not Joe Douglas's policy. They snatched you clean, they squeezed you dry, and they could have disposed of you as quietly as flushing a dead mouse down a toilet. But their boss doesn't like them to play that rough, and if he became convinced that they had, it would cost their jobs, if not their necks.
Jubal paused for a swig.
Those thugs are just a tool. They aren't a Praetorian guard that picks the Caesar.
So whom do you want for Caesar? Courthouse Joe, whose indoctrination goes back to when this country was a nation and not a satrapy in a polyglot empire. Douglas, who can't stomach assassination.
Or do you want to toss him out?
We can, just by double-crossing him. Toss him out and put in a secretary general from a land where life is cheap and assassination a tradition.
If you do, Ben, what happens to the next snoopy newspaper man who walks down a dark alley?
Caxton didn't answer.
As I said, the SS is just a tool. Men are always for hire who like dirty work. How dirty will that work become if you nudge Douglas out of his majority?
Jubal, are you saying I ought not to criticize the administration?
Nope. Gadflies are necessary. But it's well to look at the new rascals before you turn your present rascals out. Democracy is a poor system. The only thing can be said for it is that it's 8 times as good as any other method. Its worst fault is that its leaders reflect their constituents, a low level. But what can you expect? So look at Douglas and ponder that, in his ignorance, stupidity, and self-seeking, he resembles his fellow Americans, but is a notch or two above average. Then look at the man who will replace him if his government topples.
There's a little difference.
There's always a difference. This is between bad and worse, which is much sharper than that between good and better.
Well, what do you want me to do?
Nothing, Harshaw answered. I'll run this show myself. I expect you to refrain from chewing out Joe Douglas over this coming settlement. Maybe praise him for statesmanlike restraint. You're making me vomit. Use your hat. I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do. The first principle in riding a tiger is to hang on tight to its ears. Quit being pompous. What's the deal? Quit being obtuse and listen. Mike has the misfortune to be heir to more wealth than Croesus dreamed of, plus a claim to political power under a politico-judicial precedent unparalleled in jugheadedness since Secretary Fall was convicted of receiving a bribe that Doheny was acquitted of paying. I have no interest in true prince nonsense, nor do I regard that wealth as his. He didn't produce it. Even if he had earned it, property is not the natural and obvious concept that most people think it is. Come again? Ownership is a sophisticated abstraction, a mystical relationship. God knows our legal theorists make this mystery complicated. But I didn't dream how subtle it was until I got the Martian slant. Martians don't own anything. Not even their bodies. Wait a minute, Jubal. Even animals have property. And the Martians aren't animals. They're a civilization with cities and all sorts of things. Yes. Foxes have holes, and the birds of the air have nests. Nobody understands Mia set to us better than a watchdog. But not Martians, unless you regard joint ownership of everything by millions or billions of senior citizens, ghosts, to you, my friend, as property. Say, Jubal, how about these old ones? You want the official version? No, your opinion. I think it is pious poppycock, suitable for enriching lawns. Superstition burned into the boy's brain so early that he stands no chance of breaking loose. Jill talks as if she believed it. You will hear me talk as if I did, too. Ordinary politeness. One of my most valued friends believes in astrology. I would never offend her by telling her what I think. The capacity of humans to believe in what seems to me highly improbable, from table-tapping to the superiority of their children, has never been plumbed. Faith strikes me as intellectual laziness. But Mike's faith in his old ones is no more irrational than a conviction that the dynamics of the universe can be set aside through prayers for rain. Jubal, I confess to a suspicion that immortality is a fact. But I'm glad my grandfather's ghost doesn't boss me. He was a cranky old devil. And so was mine. And so am I. But is there any reason why a citizen's franchise should be voided simply because he is dead? The precinct I was raised in had a large graveyard vote, almost Martian. As may be, our lad Mike can't own anything, because the old ones already own everything. So I have trouble explaining to him that he owns over 1 million shares of Luna Enterprises, plus the Lyle Drive, plus assorted chattels and securities. It doesn't help that the original owners are dead, and that makes them old ones. Mike would never stick his nose into the business of old ones. Damn it, he's incompetent. Of course. He can't manage property because he doesn't believe in its mystique, any more than I believe in his ghosts. Ben, all that Mike owns is a toothbrush, and he doesn't know he owns that. If you took it, he would assume that the old ones had authorized the change. Jubal shrugged. He is incompetent, so I shan't allow his competency to be tried. For what guardian would be appointed? Douglas, or one of his stooges. Are you certain, Ben? Consider the makeup of the High Court. Might not the appointee be named Savonavong, or Nadi, or Key? You could be right. In which case the lad might not live long. Or he might live to a ripe age in some pleasant garden more difficult to escape from than Bethesda Hospital. What do you plan to do? The power the boy nominally owns is too dangerous. So we give it away. How do you give away that much money? You don't. Giving it away would change the balance of power. Any attempt would cause the boy to be examined on his competence. So instead we let the tiger run like hell while hanging on to its ears for dear life. Ben, let me outline what I intend to do. Then you do your damnedest to pick holes in it. Not the legality. Douglas's legal staff will write the double talk and I'll check it. I want you to sniff it for political feasibility. Now, here's what we are going to do. Chapter 19. The Martian diplomatic delegation went to the Executive Palace the next morning.
The unpretentious pretender to the Martian throne, Mike Smith, did not worry about the purpose of the trip. He simply enjoyed it. They rode a chartered flying greyhound. Mike sat in the Astrodome, Jill on one side and Dorcas on his other, and stared as the girls pointed out sights and chattered. The seat was intended for two. A warming growing closer resulted. He sat with an arm around each and looked and listened and tried to grok, and could not have been happier if he had been 10 feet underwater. It was his first view of Terran civilization. He had seen nothing in being removed from the Champion. He had spent a few minutes in a taxi 10 days earlier, but had grokked none of it. Since then his world had been bounded by house and pool, garden and grass and trees. He had not been as far as Jubal's Gate. But now he was sophisticated. He understood windows, realized that the bubble surrounding him was for looking out of, and that the sights he saw were cities. He picked out, with the help of the girls, where they were on the map flowing across the lapboard. He had not known until recently that humans knew about maps. It had given him a twinge of happy homesickness, the first time he had grokked a human map. It was static and dead compared with maps used by his people. But it was a map. Even human maps were Martian in essence. He liked them. He saw almost 200 miles of countryside, most of it sprawling world metropolis, and savored every inch, tried to grok it. He was startled by the size of human cities and their bustling activity, so different from the monastery garden cities of his own people. It seemed to him that a human city must wear out almost at once, so choked with experience that only the strongest old ones could bear to visit its deserted streets and grok in contemplation events and emotions piled layer on endless layer in it. He had visited abandoned cities at home on a few wonderful and dreadful occasions. Then his teachers had stopped it, grokking that he was not strong enough. Questions to Jill and Dorcas enabled him to grok the city's age. It had been founded a little over 2 Earth centuries ago. Since Earth time units had no favor for him, he converted to Martian years and numbers. 3 filled plus 3 waiting years. 3 to the 4th power plus 3 to the 3rd power equals 108 Martian years. Terrifying and beautiful. Why, these people must be prepared to abandon the city to its thoughts before it shattered under the strain and became not. Yet, by mere time, the city was only an egg. Mike looked forward to returning to Washington in a century or two to walk its empty streets and try to grow close to its endless pain and beauty, grokking thirstily until he was Washington and the city was himself. If he were strong enough by then. He filed the thought, as he must grow and grow and grow before he would be able to praise and cherish the city's mighty anguish. The Greyhound driver swung east in response to a rerouting of unscheduled traffic, caused, unknown to Mike, by Mike's presence. And Mike saw the sea. Jill had to tell him that it was water. Dorcas added that it was the Atlantic Ocean and traced the shoreline on the map. Mike had known since he was a nestling that the planet next nearer the sun was almost covered with the water of life, and lately he had learned that these people accepted this richness casually. He had taken the more difficult hurdle of grokking the Martian orthodoxy that water ceremony did not require water. Water was symbol for essence, beautiful, but not indispensable. But Mike discovered that knowing in abstract was not the same as physical reality. The Atlantic filled him with such awe that Jill said sharply, "Mike, don't you dare!" Mike chopped off his emotion and stored it. Then he stared at water stretching to horizon and tried to measure it until his head was buzzing with threes and powers of threes and superpowers of powers. As they landed on the palace, Jubal called out,
"Remember, girls, form a square around him and don't be backward about planting a heel or jabbing an elbow. And you'll be cloaked, but that's no reason not to step on a foot if you're crowded. Or is it?"
"Quit fretting, boss. Nobody crowds a witness. And I'm wearing spike heels and way more than you do."
"Okay, Duke, send Larry back with the bus as soon as possible."
"I grok it, boss."
"Quit jittering." "I'll jitter as I please. Let's go."
Harshaw, the four girls, with Mike and Caxton, got out. The bus took off. The landing flat was not crowded, but it was far from empty. A man stepped forward and said heartily,
"Dr. Harshaw, I'm Tom Bradley, senior executive assistant to the Secretary General. You are to go to Mr. Douglas's office. He will see you before the conference starts." "No."
Bradley blinked.
I don't think you understood. These are instructions from the Secretary General.
Oh, he said that it was all right for Mr. Smith to come with you.
The man from Mars, I mean. No, we're going to the conference room. Have somebody lead the way. In the meantime, I have an errand for you. Miriam, that letter.
But Dr. Harshaw...
I said no. You ought to deliver this to Mr. Douglas at once and fetch his receipt to me.
Harshaw signed across the flap of an envelope Miriam handed to him, pressed his thumbprint over the signature, handed it to Bradley.
Tell him that he must read this at once, before the meeting.
But the Secretary General desires...
The Secretary desires to see that letter.
Young man, I am endowed with second sight. I prophesy that you won't be here tomorrow if you waste time getting it to him.
Bradley said, Jim, take over, and left with the letter. Jubal sighed. He had sweated over that letter. Anne and he had been up most of the night preparing draft after draft. Jubal intended to arrive at an open settlement, but he had no intention of taking Douglas by surprise. A man stepped forward in answer to Bradley's order. Jubal sized him up as one of the clever young men on the make who gravitate to those in power and do their dirty work. The man smiled and said,
The name's Jim Sanforth, Doctor. I'm the chief's press secretary. I'll be buffering for you from now on, arranging press interviews and so forth. I'm sorry to say that the conference is not ready. At the last minute, we've had to move to a larger room. It's my thought that...
It's my thought that we'll go to that conference room right now.
Doctor, you don't understand. They are stringing wires and things. The room is swarming with reporters and...
Very well. We'll chat with them.
No, Doctor... I have instructions.
Youngster, you can take your instructions, fold them until they're all corners, and shove them in your oubliette. We are here for one purpose, a public conference. If the conference is not ready, we'll see the press in the conference room.
But
you're keeping the man from Mars standing on a windy roof.
Harshaw raised his voice.
Is there anyone smart enough to lead us to this conference room?
Sanforth swallowed and said,
Follow me, Doctor.
The conference room was alive with newsmen and technicians, but there was a big oval table, chairs, and several smaller tables. Mike was spotted, and Sanforth's protest did not keep the crowd back. Mike's flying wedge of Amazons got him to the big table. Jubal sat him against it with Dorcas and Jill flanking him, and the fair witness and Miriam seated behind him. Then, Jubal made no attempt to fend off questions or pictures. Mike had been told that people would do strange things, and Jubal had warned him to take no sudden actions, such as causing persons or things to go away or stop, unless Jill told him to. Mike took the confusion gravely. Jill was holding his hand, and her touch reassured him. Jubal wanted pictures, the more the better. As for questions, he did not fear them. A week of talking with Mike had convinced him that no reporter could get anything out of Mike without expert help. Mike's habit of answering literally and stopping would nullify attempts to pump him. Most questions Mike answered with, I do not know, or beg pardon. A Reuters correspondent, anticipating a fight over Mike's status as an heir, tried to sneak in his own test of Mike's competence.
Mr. Smith, what do you know about the laws of inheritance?
Mike knew that he was having trouble grokking the human concept of property, and in particular the ideas of bequest and inheritance. So he stuck to the book, which Jubal recognized as Eli on Inheritance and Bequest, Chapter 1. Mike recited what he had read with precision and no expression for page after page, while the room settled into silence and his interrogator gulped. Jubal let it go on, until every newsman there knew more than he wanted to know about dower and courtesy, consanguinean and uterine, per stirpes and per capita. At last, Jubal said,
That's enough, Mike.
Mike looked puzzled.
There is more.
Later. Does someone have a question on another subject?
A reporter for a London Sunday paper jumped in with one close to his employer's pocketbook.
Mr. Smith, we understand you like girls. Have you ever kissed a girl?
Yes.
Did you like it?
Yes.
How did you like it?
Mike hardly hesitated.
Kissing girls is a goodness, he explained. It beats the hell out of card games.
Their applause frightened him. But he could feel that Jill and Dorcas were not frightened. They were trying to restrain that noisy expression of pleasure which he could not learn. So he calmed his fright and waited.
He was saved from further questions and was granted a great joy. He saw a familiar figure entering.